Way back in 1985, Mr. Herbert Armstrong made a statement that I think became rather famous. I've heard it quoted many times since then. The statement that he made back then was, "Half of you don't get it." How many of you remember him saying that? Quite a few of you. How many of you weren't in the church yet in 1985? How many of you weren't even born yet in 1985? It seems like only yesterday, and it was, 28 years ago that he made that statement. And of course, when he said it, we thought, "You've got to be kidding. You must be mistaken. Half of us don't get it. Aren't we all converted here? Don't we all have God's Spirit? Aren't we a part of the church of God? And you're saying half of us don't get it? What's he talking about?" You see, we saw ourselves as immune to some of the problems that this world has. We saw ourselves immune from wrong attitudes and wrong ideas and worldliness and carnality. We saw ourselves as being God's people. And surely these things don't affect us. You remember the last sermon I gave here? I gave it here 2 weeks ago. And in that sermon I talked about when I was at the feast in 1970. And I went into that store in the Poconos. And I saw a girl brought up to the counter who was accused of shoplifting. I told you this just a few weeks ago. And when her mother was brought up to the counter to account for this, because there were so many in the church in the Poconos at the feast that year, every merchant on the strip knew us. And the first question he asked was, "Are you all with the church?" And when the lady said yes, I thought, "That can't be true. She's lying. That can't possibly be true. Because no one in the church would be shoplifting." And I didn't believe it when I saw her at services the next day. We're not immune to this world's problems. I think there was a time that we didn't see that we could have any worldliness in us at all. There was a time when we just felt like we were above all of that. We were outside of that realm of worldliness. What was it that Herbert Armstrong saw that caused him to make that statement? What was in his mind when he said, "Half of you don't get it"? Did he see church members acting in unconverted ways? Was he aware of certain attitudes that were at that time brewing in the church? Certain areas of unrest, maybe, that were just starting to come together. Of course, we all know what happened shortly thereafter. A few months after he made that statement, Mr. Armstrong died. And within 10 years, we saw heresy introduced into the church as multiple doctrines were changed. A lot of things changed in the church at that time, in the mid-90s. The Sabbath and the holy days were no longer taught as things that were commanded. The doctrine of clean and unclean meats was just totally thrown out the window. And I remember hearing a sermon one time where it was actually stated that God doesn't expect us to follow that law anymore. That's not for us. And wouldn't you know it, that very night, hundreds or maybe thousands of church members went out to have a lobster dinner without even bothering to check and see if what the minister was now teaching was right or not. Now, I remember hearing that, and I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to change anything I'm doing until I prove what's being said here, or disprove, as the case may be. But that was one of the doctrines that was changed. And then, of course, tithing became optional in favor of voluntary giving. And so all these different things started changing in the church. Just a few years after Herbert Armstrong said, "Half of you don't get it." And maybe now we were starting to understand what he was talking about. Because approximately 90% of the church as it turns out, was no longer following the basic doctrines. 90% of the church abandoned what we had taught for so many years. Now, Mr. Armstrong's estimate of 50%, or half of the church, seemed like a low estimate then, didn't it? It was more than 50%, perhaps. Was it the fact that 90% didn't get it? Or was there maybe another factor which caused a lot of people to leave at that time? I'm going to say that there was something else there that caused many people not to get it. A lot of people didn't get it, didn't understand, weren't with the program. And I'm here today to tell you that that something is still there. It's still out there, and it's a threat to us. Because in 1995, you see, it caught a lot of people off guard. A lot of people actually left God's church because of it. It caught them off guard, and it is still there, and it can catch us off guard as well. It can cause you to lose what you already have. It can cause you to lose God's truth. It can cause you to lose God's Spirit. It can cause you to lose a godly way of thinking. It can cause you to lose sound reasoning. It can cause you to lose everything that you have that God has given you. If we aren't aware, we could easily fall victim to it. This thing that is still out there is Satan's ability to infiltrate our minds and deceive us, to influence us to do the things that we wouldn't otherwise do. See, it's Satan's goal to get us out of God's church. It's Satan's goal to destroy us, to destroy the church. And of course, since we know he's out there, and since we know he's trying to do this, we're on our guard against him. But he is trying to get us out of God's church without us even knowing it. Well, how's he going to do that? How can he take us out of the church without us even knowing it? Let me show you how he did it before. In 1995, he first brought heresy into the ministry. The ministers started teaching things that weren't biblical. And there were a lot of people in the church who would have never considered leaving the church. They were in the worldwide church of God, and they would never leave because they were that dedicated to God and to his way. But when the heresy came from within, when it came from the ministry, they remained because they would never leave the church. And they left the truth, and they, in that way, left God's church without even realizing it. They felt they were still there. They thought they were still a part of it. Satan got them to leave God's church without them even realizing what they had done. It happened before, and it can easily happen again. I'm not saying that there's a threat that it's going to. I'm saying that Satan is still there, and he uses the same tactics. And he's still there and can do it again in some other way. The danger is when we fail to recognize how much power Satan has. He has a lot of power to influence us, and that's what I want to talk about. Because it's a very dangerous thing when we start to become too sure of ourselves. When we start to think, well, I have God's Spirit. Satan can't influence me at all. Satan can't do anything to me. Because I know better. I'm a member of God's church. You know, I can't be deceived. Is it possible to be too confident in our spiritual state? Is it possible that maybe we're just a little bit overconfident in our ability to recognize deceit, to recognize rebellion? And we think that Satan can't deceive us because we have God's Spirit? If so, we're kind of underestimating Satan's power. We can't do that. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 24. Notice what it says here. It says, "For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect." The elect can be deceived. There will be those who will rise up and it will look good what they're saying. It will sound right. But it says, even the elect can be deceived. Even those with God's Spirit, if they're not careful, can be deceived by this satanic device. None of us are immune to it. The world is kind of like a river. I'm going to make an analogy here. The world is like a river. That you look at the river and you're looking at it from a distance and it looks so nice and calm and peaceful and it looks like just the kind of place you'd like to be out there floating around in your boat, just enjoying the river and enjoying the scenery. The world is attractive in some ways. There are a lot of things about this world that attract our attention. At a distance, this river might look calm and peaceful. Then when you get up close to it, you see that, hey, this river is moving. This river has a current, and it's constantly moving. You don't notice that from a distance, but when you get up close, you see it. And especially when you get into a boat and go out into the river, you feel the effects of the current, and you can feel that it's pulling you downstream. And it's only when you're out in a boat in this river that you really feel the full effects of the current and realize how strong it is. Now, many, many years ago, I had a small boat. I had a little 12-foot boat. It had a little 7.5-horsepower air-cooled motor on it. I've been there. I know what it's like to be pulled down with the current. There was one time when I was in Ocean City, and we were fishing out in the bay, and that little 7.5-horsepower motor didn't want to start. We had pulled the anchor up and tried to start the motor, but it didn't start. We started drifting. Now, the bay behind Ocean City gets pretty strong. The current gets pretty strong. And I think we started out, we were up somewhere around 22nd Street or so, just off of the shoreline at 22nd Street in the bay. And in just a matter of no time, in trying to get the motor started, we found ourselves down around 4th Street. The current had taken us down there so quickly. And it's like, you know, we couldn't get this motor started, and if we didn't hurry and get it started, it was going to take us right out into the ocean. It would have carried us right on under the bridge and around through the inlet, and we'd be out in the ocean. And if it weren't for the fact that we caught on to a pier or a bulkhead down around 4th Street, that we'd have just kept going. So we managed to pull in there and work on the motor and get it started again. But sometimes you don't realize how strong of a pull that is until you're out in it and you can't get your motor started. Do we ever underestimate what Satan is capable of doing? Do we ever underestimate the current that is in this world that's trying to pull us along its way? Maybe sometimes we get a little confident that Satan can't overcome us, that we have God's Spirit, and we're strong. We think we're strong. Just having God's Spirit doesn't mean he can't deceive you. You know, Satan is clever. He's very clever. He's very crafty. And when he sets out to deceive someone, you know, it's really a bonus for him if that person he deceives is a church member. You know, I can just see, you know, Satan deceives a lot of people. He's deceived the whole world. But when he deceives a church member, I can just see him and the demons just high-fiving each other because they got a big one. You know, they got one that thought he could never be deceived. So they consider church members to be a bonus when they pull them over to their side. None of us are immune to any of this. None of us are above being deceived. And we need to understand that first of all. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 6. Paul makes it very clear that we can be deceived. But he's warning against that very thing. In Ephesians 5, verse 6, it says here, "Let no one deceive you with empty words." He wouldn't have said that if it weren't possible to deceive someone with God's Spirit. We can be deceived as much as anybody else. "Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience." Satan will, through his followers, try to deceive us. Those who go his way, those who are living his way, are his followers, and they will try to deceive us. In 1 John chapter 2, John writes here about the same thing, that there are those who will try to deceive you. He says here, "These things I have written to you concerning those who try to deceive you." In 1 John 2:26, John says, there are those out there who are trying. They're trying to get you, trying to influence you. And this warning is not limited to doctrinal deception. I'm not just talking about clean and unclean meats or keeping the Sabbath. In other words, what we're talking about here, this deception, can include things like seeing something as good, which is really evil. Seeing something that you like or you approve of, and yet it's inherently evil, and maybe you don't even realize it. Let me give you some examples. Maybe you see a movie that kind of gets your attention, it kind of interests you. And so you start watching this movie. Only you find out about halfway through that there's this underlying theme to the movie. And it's really not a very good thing, not something that we should be watching. And sometimes you don't realize that right away, but you start watching it and you get interested in it. And the next thing you know, you want to watch more movies like it. And so you've seen one and you want to see another. And so you kind of overlook the evil theme to it, and it's working on your mind. It's influencing your mind. Maybe it's pleasant music that you're listening to. You listen to a song, you hear a song on the radio or somewhere that, oh, that sounds like a nice song. I kind of like that. And then you listen to the words. And after you listen to the words, you realize that it has some really offensive lyrics to it. Now, I know there are a lot of songs that I listened to when I was growing up that I really liked the songs. Never really paid too much attention to all the lyrics, but kind of liked the songs. And then years later, I listened to the words, and I'm like, wow, I didn't know that was what that was about. I didn't know that was what the words really were saying. Some of it might have been obscure or hard to understand or whatever. You find out later on that all this music that you really, really like has a bit of offensive lyrics to it. It's some things that aren't really good for us to be putting into our minds. Or it might be something like good friends. Maybe you have good friends who are neighbors or somebody you work with that you happen to be good friends with, and they seem to be good people, and you enjoy being with them, and maybe you get work up a good friendship with them. But then those people might turn out to be a bad influence on you down the road. There might be something about them, because they're not converted, they're not church members, and maybe they have a bad influence on you. But they're good friends, so you continue to hang out with them. Maybe that's not the best thing, but this is the way sometimes that Satan, through his followers, will try to get into our minds and infiltrate us. You know, we might be able to deal with people who are trying to influence us in some way. But Satan is not just a person. He's more than a person. He's a much more powerful being. You know what it says in Ephesians 6, verse 12? Let's look at it and think about what it really is saying here. Ephesians 6, verse 12. It says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood." We're not dealing with a human being here. "But against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. We're talking about wickedness itself. Everything that is wicked, everything that is evil, comes from this being. And he is a powerful being. We're dealing with the ruler of the darkness of this age. What does that tell you? He's not like any physical enemy we would encounter. And we have to remember just how powerful he is and just how clever he is. Because he knows how to get to us. He knows what our thoughts are. He knows the way we think. Hey, we're humans. He knows the way humans think. And he knows how to affect us. But Satan's world can quickly pull us downstream, just like that river. We get out there in a boat and we don't have any means of controlling anything, that river will take us right downstream, and who knows where we'll end up. This world is designed, just like that river, to look attractive from a distance. It's designed to look appealing. You know, some of the things that we see on television might attract our attention. And then we start watching it and we find out, hey, this isn't godly at all. Up close, you start to see that it's not what it seemed to be. And if we do get involved in it, if we allow ourselves to get involved in some of the things that Satan tries to put in our minds, then we can literally be swept away. Just like the current in a river will sweep you away if you're caught up in it. Some of the things can become addicting. Some of the things that Satan sends your way or tries to influence you with can become addicting. And I'm not just talking about narcotics here. I'm not just talking about drugs. I'm talking about things that can be addicting, like some types of movies. Now, I know a few years back, the Harry Potter movies were big. And people might have gone out to see the first one and got hooked on it. And then they had to go see the next one, and they had to see the third one, and however many there were, I'm not even sure. But it's something that could have become addicting to them, and something that's not really what we want to be putting into our minds. Movies and TV shows about vampires, or about the occult, or about witchcraft, things like that, that at first we might be attracted to it, but then we get into it and find out that it's just evil, and something that should not be allowed into our minds. But that's the way Satan does it. He just gives us a little bit at first, just enough to attract us and to get us addicted to it. How about video games? Video games can be addicting, can't they? I'm not just talking to kids, I'm talking to adults too. Some video games on the internet actually cost money. I saw an article on the news the other day about one particular video game, I forget what it was called, but you get to a certain level and then you have to pay to keep going. And people get so addicted to it that they're spending hours and hours. We're talking adults here. They're spending hours playing these games. And while it might not be wrong to play a game on your computer, certainly if it's costing you a lot of money and you're addicted to it, or if it's taking up too much of your time when you should be doing other things or spending time with the family or whatever, you know, it can be hurtful to you and to your family. It can be something that you want to keep out of your mind, because Satan is trying to destroy your family. He's trying to destroy you and your finances and everything else, and he'll do anything he can to do that. Or it might have something to do with alcohol. He might try to influence you to have another drink when you've already had one. You know, you might think you're drinking in moderation. You go to a restaurant and you have a glass of beer with your meal. Waitress comes around, would you like another beer? Yeah, maybe I would. Maybe I would like another. And so the next thing you know, you have a second one. And then before you leave, you want one before you go. And, you know, it might not seem like much at first, but what about next time? What about when you go home? Maybe alcohol starts to become a problem for you. It doesn't happen overnight. I'm not saying it's going to happen just like that. But over time, these things can become addicting. Don't even need to tell you about gambling, how addicting that can be. oh, I'll just buy this one lottery ticket. You know, I can spend a dollar. Powerball jackpot is $150 million. Just think what I could do with that. And it sounds so attractive when you hear about it. It's only a dollar. I can invest a dollar. I'm not going to miss that. And who knows? I might strike it rich. And so you go out and you buy a ticket and you lose. And the next thing you think of is, well, I lost because the odds were so stacked against me. But if I buy 10 tickets next time, it'll increase my chances by 10. And so before long, you find yourself addicted to that. And then there's pornography. And you might think, well, certainly somebody in the church would not ever get involved in that. I want to tell you something. I have known people in the church who have had that problem. We're not immune to it. We're not immune to that. A guy gets on the computer and he looks and he sees something that attracts his attention. And maybe he's not lusting or anything, but he sees something that just... he has to do a double take because he sees this, and next thing you know, he's looking for something else. And it doesn't seem to be a problem at first, or at least he convinces himself it's not a problem, but it becomes one over time. And the next thing you know, he's hooked into it. It might start out small and seemingly or apparently innocent. Maybe it's not so innocent, but it seems that way when we get hooked into one of these things. But it's just like catching a fish on a line. You know, once that fish is hooked, it's all over. And that's what Satan's doing. He wants you to see things as okay or as not necessarily sinful, but attractive. He wants you to see things as acceptable from a distance. And then once you start paying attention to it, boom, he's got you. He's got you hooked. Don't think that these addictions can't affect church members. Like I said, I've known more than one who had a pornography addiction, and there have been several who have had alcohol problems as well. There have been some who have had gambling problems. We are not immune to these things, and we need to realize that. Don't ever say, this can't happen to me. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12. Because sometimes we think that we're above all that. And Satan can't get to us because we're so spiritual. And you don't want to get into a self-righteous attitude here either. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. I don't care how much you think you're on solid ground, spiritually speaking, you can still fall. You can still be taken down. And you need to be aware and be on your guard. You see, we're powerless by ourselves. We don't stand a chance against Satan and against his evil devices. But we have God's Spirit. And God's Spirit is one of power. God's Spirit is a spirit of power. But wouldn't we recognize, wouldn't we be able to see if Satan were trying to deceive us? You might say, well, I know not to let myself be deceived. I know not to let Satan get to me. But you see, we're weak. We're powerless. Human beings are weak in comparison to Satan. We by ourselves are no match for his craftiness. Remember the boat and how fast the current was moving it? Remember when I told you that I was in that boat and was drifting with the current that time? Imagine yourself in a boat trying to row against the current. You've got a set of oars there and you're trying to row upstream. But the current is moving so fast that you're not moving upstream, you're just not moving downstream quite so fast. And you're getting tired by doing it because you're constantly rowing and you're giving it all you've got. But you can't overcome the current by yourself. That's the way it is with Satan. You can't overcome him by yourself. One person and two oars don't have a chance against a swift current. You'll get worn out fighting it, and you still end up downstream. So you're not going to make it. And having your boat carried by a swift current is frightening, because you don't know where you're going to end up. Are you going to go out into the ocean? Are you going to end up going over some rapids? You don't know what's ahead. You don't know where it's going to take you. But you know it's not going to be good. It's not taking you where you want to be. But you know, there's always a way to overcome Satan's craftiness. As we read the very next verse here in 1 Corinthians 10, in verse 13 it says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." God knows that Satan is going to try you, and he's going to tempt you. And he's going to do things to try and get you to go his way, to float downstream with the rest of the world. God says that he will have this way of escape for you every single time. If you have God's Spirit, if God is working in your life, he will make a way of escape that you can bear it. See, God gives us the means to fight whatever Satan throws at us. He gives us that. That's a gift. The way of escape. He gives us that escape hatch, but there's one problem. God isn't going to pull us through the escape hatch. He provides the opening, but we have to crawl through it, or walk through it, or whatever. We have to take ourselves out of it. He just provides the way. He's not going to take us out, but he's going to just provide the way out. Let's put all this another way. Our boat floating out in the river, a river with a strong current that we can't overcome with our oars, our boat has the means to overcome that current. God's Spirit is like that outboard motor that's bolted onto the stern. There's a motor back there that is powerful enough to overcome the current and take the boat upstream. If you start the motor, the river is no match for your boat. Yet no problem. No worries. You'll go right upstream and get right where you want to be, and you won't go along with the current. Now, in the boat that I had, the motor that I had on there, that little 7.5 horsepower motor, you had to start it like this by pulling the cord. Sometimes it was a little hard to start. That's why we had the problem that day down in Ocean City. Couldn't get that thing started. Sometimes we had to pull the starter cord 7 or 8, 9 times, 10 times just to get it going. You know, that starter rope isn't going to pull itself. God gives us the motor, but we have to pull the cord. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 6. Timothy 1 verse 6 says, "Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." God's Spirit is a spirit of power, but it has to be stirred up. We have to do something here. We have to use it. He doesn't give us his Spirit and then that solves all of our problems and we just let his Spirit do it all and we don't do anything. We have to stir it up. We have to use it. We have to crank it up. We have to pull the rope and get the motor started. That motor is not going to do us any good if we don't pull the cord, if we don't start it. As long as we crank the motor and we keep gas in the tank, we'll have power and we'll be able to go on upstream. But God isn't going to do that for us. He's just providing us with the power. He provides us with the motor. We have to want to use it. It has to be in our heart to use it. Remember, we can't fight this current on our own. We need help. God gives us the help, but we have to use it. Would you rather drift down the river than pull the rope? Now, with the motor that I had, sometimes it was a lot of effort to get it going. I had a lot of trouble with that motor, as I recall, trying to get it started. It took a lot of work. And sometimes it was easier just to let it go and just drift around. And we'd be out there fishing, and instead of going where we wanted, we just forget the motor, and we'll just drift wherever, and we'll fish wherever we end up. You don't want to just drift down the way that Satan wants you to go. God's Spirit is a spirit of power. God's Spirit is a spirit of love. You know, human nature is inherently selfish. And it looks out for its own interests, generally. The carnal mind is not godly, and it acts against God's Spirit. Notice in Romans chapter 8, verse 6. It talks about the carnal mind here in Romans chapter 8. I'll read verses 6 through 8. It says, "For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So then those who are in the flesh cannot please God." The carnal mind acts contrary to God. The carnal mind shows no love toward God. The carnal mind acts contrary to humanity and seeks its own selfish way. You see, the carnal mind is spiritually lazy. Spiritually lazy. It would rather just drift down the river, just go with the flow, and not exert any energy whatsoever. So much easier than pulling that rope to start the motor. So much easier just to drift downstream. God's Spirit is what makes the difference in us. It's what overcomes that carnal mind. Verse 9 says, "So then those who are in the flesh cannot please God. But you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his." Without God's Spirit, we don't have that connection with God, and Christ is not in us. Now, I know that the phrase "Christ in us" is misunderstood by some people. Saying Christ in us simply means that we live the way He lived, that we have that same mindset in us. It doesn't mean that He's literally in us and He's living our life for us. No, He's not living our life for us. We live with the same attitude as Christ had. That's what it means. We live with that same spirit and with those same goals and the same attitude that Jesus Christ had. That's what it means to have Christ in us. It doesn't mean that we just sit back and let Christ drive the boat, because it doesn't work that way. God's Spirit is something that needs to be stirred up. With God's Spirit, we abandon that selfish human nature and we put on love. No longer do we put ourselves ahead of God and ahead of others. And love does not parade itself, and love does not seek its own. Isn't that what it says? 1 John 4, verse 4. First John chapter 4, verse 4. It says, "You are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. They are of the world, therefore they speak as of the world, and the world hears them. We are of God. He who knows God hears us. He who is not of God does not hear us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Beloved, let us love one another. For love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." If God's Spirit is in us, we will have that godly love. We will have that concern for other other men, other people. We will have that love for God. We will have that love for one another to the point where we become a servant of one another. That's what we're supposed to be. We're servants of God. One of God's attributes is that He is love. Verse 9, it says, "In this the love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent His only begotten Son into the world that we might live through Him. And this is love, not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins." So we see the love that God had for us in the great sacrifice that He made for us by giving His Son for us. If we have that same spirit, we will share that same love. In verse 11 it says, "Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another." Love is a sign that we have God's Spirit. So we keep reading in verse 12. It says, "No one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us, and His love has been perfected in us. By this we know that we abide in Him, and He in us, because He has given us of His Spirit." And then in verse 16 it says, "And we have known and believed the love that God has for us. God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him." God's Spirit is a spirit of love. If we have that Spirit, first and foremost, we will have love toward God. And then we will have love for man, but especially for each other, especially for one another in God's church. We'll have that love for one another with God's Spirit. Love was evident among the membership of the New Testament church. In Acts chapter 2, verse 44, notice what it says here. Demonstrates how much love they had for each other. In Acts 2, verse 44. It says, "Now all who believed were together and had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods, and divided them among all, as anyone had need." These people were sharing everything they had with each other because they had that kind of love for one another. Nobody was ever in need because of the sharing that went on. They took care of each other's needs. With God's Spirit, their lives were simple. Their lives were happy. Verse 46, it says, "So continuing daily with one accord in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart." They had love for one another. Is that same love apparent in the church today? Do we have that same love? Are we stirring up God's Spirit to that extent where we have that love for one another? You know, God's Spirit hasn't changed, but our world has. Our world has certainly changed over the years. The current has gotten a lot stronger. There are a lot more rocks in the river now than there were before. You know what happens when you're riding your boat in a rocky river? River that's got a lot of stones and rocks in it just below the surface? You have to be very careful. You'll hit your propeller. You'll damage the propeller and your boat will stop. You won't go anywhere. That's the world we live in today. It's gotten a lot stronger and a lot more rocky. We're living in a more physically oriented society today than ever before. There are many more distractions and there are many more temptations around us. There are more things today to get our minds back onto ourselves. That won't happen if we're stirring up God's Spirit. That won't happen if we have that godly love for one another. It just won't happen. We won't get distracted. We won't get tempted. We'll be able to overcome because we are using that Spirit of God. Perhaps this is what Mr. Armstrong was talking about when he said, "Half of you don't get it." Maybe he saw a church where there wasn't the same love as it once had. Maybe he saw that people weren't showing that love for one another anymore. is there a large percentage of the church today who don't get it? Is there a large percentage of the church today not having that love for one another? Remember, God's Spirit is a spirit of power, and it's a spirit of love. God's Spirit is also a spirit of a sound mind. The words sound mind are translated from the Greek word sophronismos, which means discipline or self-control. With all the distractions of Satan's society, discipline is not always easy. It doesn't always come easy to keep ourselves in line. There are so many things that grab our attention. And as long as we are in the flesh, we are susceptible to this world, and we are susceptible to his distractions. We can't ever allow ourselves to think that because we have God's Spirit, we can't be tempted. Satan is relentless in his attack on humanity. His broadcast of his message of selfishness is going out constantly, and everything he's trying to influence us with leads to selfishness, seeking to serve your own pleasures and your own self. That's what it's all about. That's what he's trying to instill in us. You know, you deserve this. You deserve something that, you know, something that perhaps is not good for us. He tries to get us to think on those terms. But he's broadcasting a message of selfishness. He's created a society based on pleasure seeking. And he has a way of making his way look so attractive. Without God's Spirit, we'd allow ourselves to fit right in. Without God's Spirit, without that outboard motor on the back of our boat, we just drift along with everything else, floating on downstream. Without God's Spirit, we wouldn't have that sound mind to see through it, to see through the deception, to see what Satan was up to. We wouldn't know better than to just play along, just to go with the flow. With God's Spirit, we're armed with what we need to fight Satan's attacks. We have access to the help that we need in order to discipline ourselves. Self-discipline is not an easy thing. God's Spirit helps us with that. We need to discipline ourselves in order to reach our goal. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, I'll start reading in verse 24. You know, we need God's Spirit, but as I said before, we need to be stirring it up. We need to be using it, because God will give us the motor, but we have to pull the cord. We have to put the gas in the tank. We have to get it started. 1 Corinthians 9:24 says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." We have to discipline ourselves. God's Spirit will help us, but we have to want it. We have to work toward it. It doesn't sound like the Holy Spirit is doing it all for us, does it? We're the one to be running this race. We're the one to be disciplining our body and bringing it into subjection. We're the ones seeking that imperishable crown. God's Spirit isn't going to get it for us. We have to discipline ourselves, our actions. God's Spirit helps us do that. But we have to work at it. We have to do something. Disciplining our actions isn't enough. You know, living God's way involves more than just how we act and how we live. Living God's way also involves how we think and how we reason and how we believe. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4 and 5. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 4 and 5. It says, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." Our very thoughts need to be controlled. Not just our actions, but our thoughts. Satan attacks us by getting into the mind, by influencing our minds. Every wrong action has a wrong thought behind it. You don't do something wrong unless you've thought about it first. You think about something and the thought becomes an action. It becomes sinful. Every wrong action has a wrong thought behind it. But we have the help that we need to overcome. We have the help that we need to keep Satan's influences out of our lives. And when we discipline our thoughts, that's when you can say that we have a sound mind. God's Spirit is indeed a spirit of a sound mind. We make right decisions, we make godly decisions, and we make godly choices. So are you using the Spirit that God gave you? Are you stirring that Spirit up? Are you keeping it active? You know, it's easy to let it slide. It's easy to just let the current take over and pull our boat downstream. That's the easy way. That's the lazy way. But the problem is the current, which represents the way of the world, is going the wrong way. It's going the way that you don't want to be going. If we let it carry us, the adversary takes over. We can't do it with just our own power. We have that power of God, but we have to stir it up. We have to start the motor. We have to start that motor and start going upstream against that current. Are you keeping the influences and the temptations that Satan is broadcasting your way far away from us? Are you keeping these things out of your mind, disciplining your mind to keep it along godly lines? Along the way that God wants you to think? Only you can answer that question for yourself. You know if there's something in your life that's not quite right, something you need to correct, something you keep saying, "I need to work on this, I'll get around to doing it someday." You need to take care of these things. Take care of the things that are in your mind that shouldn't be there. Get rid of them. Keep these influences and temptations of Satan far from you. Because you know the day may come again when we come to the realization that 50% of us didn't get it. If that ever happens, just make sure that you're part of the 50% who did get it.